Hey, ladies and gentlemen, this is the podcast with a K. We are live. You may be listening to us on iTunes or Audio Boom, etc. Later on, but for now, we're live on a Sunday afternoon, 3 p.m. UK time, and we're discussing this week Doctor Who Series 9 episode, The Witch's Familiar. My chair's just gone down. I'm in slightly unfamiliar locale this week, but my co-host, Brian Terranova and James McLean are here. Hi, guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. So if anything goes a bit screwy, then they'll be able to pick things up. Like if I suddenly go like that, if something like this went, okay, that's apparently as far as it's going to go, so it's not too much of an issue. Okay, Doctor Who, The Witch is Familiar, overnight viewing figures. Doctor Who News reported this morning 3.7 million people tuned in on Saturday evening in the UK, which was a 16.6% share of the audience. From memory, Doctor Who's lost about 10% of the audience compared with Series 8. Now, slightly unusual circumstances because there was an England Rugby World Cup game being played against Wales. So there's a big chunk of audience that may have otherwise have been in there normally watching. But obviously, it's like Wales and England playing rugby together is quite a big event. And as the match progressed, it was the type of match that probably didn't lose many viewers until the very end when England lost in almost the last minute. So that's not great news, really. The rugby coverage topped the day with 10.8 million viewers, which was a 47.6% share. And more worrying is the fact that Strictly Come Dancing, which aired before Doctor Who, is that right? Strictly Come Dancing on before Doctor Who?
Probably, yeah. Probably.
Yeah, that was that got 7.7 million viewers. So that's like 4 million more on the overnight than Doctor Who got. Now, yeah, we've got iPlayer. We've got other delayed viewing things, but that still overnight. Have habits really changed so much in 12 months? I'm not so certain. So there's obviously some concern there. Let's just go into our initial feelings, and then we'll talk about something else, and then we'll come back to it. Bearing in mind how we were quite unhappy about as a team about The Magician's Apprentice last week. How are we feeling about The Witch's Familiar? Personally speaking, I thought it was miles better. It was more focused. There was a little bit of frivolity in there, but on the whole, I thought it was a massive turnaround in terms of what we'd been left with at the end of the cliffhanger. I think there was new stuff in there. There was some good new ideas. There's plenty of ideas that we've seen before, of course. But on the whole, I think it was a good recovery. Brian?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how much more I could add to that, but I felt the same, actually. And for the first time in a long time, I've actually watched this episode twice to try and see how I felt both the first and second time around, but also just because I wanted to make sure I had everything clear for talking about in this podcast. But it was enjoyable. I have to say, Peter Capaldi was on point. I thought he did a fantastic job. Julian Bleach, of course, as Davros, that was great. And Michelle Gomez as Missy just still shines for me. I think she's doing a great job. And all of them together in as you said, a more cohesive story, or at least a more cohesive half to a story, just worked a lot better for me. A couple things that I wish either didn't happen or just were different, but those things, for once it seems, were outweighed by the good. So it's one that I think has the potential to either become a classic or at least become one that I will view a heck of a lot more.
Okay, and James?
Yeah, I thought it was a lot better. I think what we said last week seemed to be inadvertently what they did this week, which was the idea to let it breathe and let the Doctor and Davros talk and allow the others to sort of play in the action and suspense. So, yeah, I think it did what should have been done last week, which, again, sort of goes back to what I said before we started this series. Do we need two-parters if two-parters are basically one-and-a-half episodes stretched out with filler, which is what I felt kind of happened here?
Too early to say, though, isn't it, after one story?
Well, this is what I said. This is my concern. Not that I'm saying this is factually what's going to happen, but this is the risk of two parters. People always presume two parters mean you're going to get a story which is expanded, so it moves at a better, it breathes and covers everything. But sometimes it can just be a story which is actually technically just a little bit longer, and then filled in with stuff to make it fit. And that's how it kind of felt in the whole thing. Although this part was very, very solid. I mean, there's lots of things we can probably pick and talk about, but as a general episode, I thought it was pretty good. I enjoyed it.
Good. I'm glad about that. Okay, then. So, I mean, that makes a nice change for us to be able to be sort of unanimous in pleasure over a Doctor Who episode. I'm thinking possibly the last time this happened was probably Mummy on the Orient Express or Flatline, depending on which podcast lineup we had on that occasion, or Last Christmas, because I think Last Christmas went down okay with us, but yeah. I'm not sure if we had three of us or just two of us on that occasion. So that's quite nice. There's a few things in there that I want to come back to later. I think now there was something else I wanted to talk about, and if I don't get it out of the way now, I will forget, and then next week the guys and I will sort this out later, how we're going to do this. But next week podcast, I'm not going to be where I am now, or where I usually am, because we've got it's the Philip Hinchcliffe events at the Fab Cafe in Manchester, which I'm going to be going to. So that means that Brian or that other fella, the cartoony guy just down there, can you see him just down there? Just down there somewhere. Yeah, there.
Me.
Around there somewhere. Depends on the size of your monitoring. It doesn't really work, to be honest with you, doing that. So that little cartoony guy in the middle there, him or the other guy, they're going to be hosting the podcast. Well, you know, it's on Google Hangouts, so that's not a big technological feat. So I'm going to be at the Philip Hinchcliffe event anyway in Manchester, and I will be able to speak to you via Hangouts from there. So that'll be kind of cool. And there might be something else going on with that. It might be podcast listener, that while you're not busy recording the podcast and editing it down and sending it to BBC Wales for them to listen to all the bad bits, that while you're not watching this bit, you'll also be able to watch the Philip Hinchcliffe event at the Fab Cafe in Manchester using their Twitter Periscope. Gareth and I have been talking about that, so that might work. There you go. Do you know, there's some bloggers who I really hate. I have to say that. Really disappointed with them, but I might come to that later on. Just in case Stephen Moffat's listening, which I know he is, because we know that. Funny the things you learn, isn't it? So the Philip Hinchcliffe event next week, that'll be fun, won't it? A great producer of Doctor Who from the 1970s who produced Doctor Who in a way that has never been produced before or since. He was a really great producer who was also able to take criticism and not be childish or angry or act in a slightly deranged or mental manner towards the fans. Philip Hinchcliffe, an absolute gentleman and a legend of Doctor Who, will be at the Fab Cafe next Sunday in Manchester, and he'll be discussing his time on the show and the other excellent projects that he did afterwards that we all look back on and think they were really great projects that he did there. They were really good productions, and I don't think there's many Doctor Who producers that we can say that about. So that's where I'll be next week. Full details are on Casterbrus. Hey, listen, Davros has got eyes. Who knew? What's that all about? I mean, I'd often thought, you know, this guy's got no eyes, so he's built this cybernetic eye. But at some point, he's got to be a bit bored and think, I think maybe it's the time I should give myself some new eyes. I'd always assumed he just had no eyes and he'd lost them in the accident. But well, it turns out he had eyes.
Yeah, that's because assumptions are the mother of all mistakes, aren't they?
Yeah.
I mean, I've had people ask me this as well, and I kind of sort of say, well, you know, he's lived a long time, so maybe he has got some eyes since, but prefers his more electronic eye, or maybe his eyesight isn't very good. You know, maybe it's sort of like a sort of glaucoma sort of thing in his eyes, and he can't see very much through them, which is pretty naff if you're a scientist, and scientists like to look a bit detail, and so they're just superfluous.
Yeah.
I'm amazed. I'm amazed that has amazed people more than other things in there. I still find it quite interesting that that Davros's wheelchair, which is being designed to carry a legless torso, actually has room in it for someone to have who has got legs in it. I thought that was quite interesting. But, you know, again, yeah, we know why they did it, and it was a bit of fun, and you go with these sort of things in the same way you accept Ian Chesterton or William Hartnell or, you know, or Clara being inside a Dalek and able to sort of scooch up in there and push everything else aside. You know, you let it go. But that sort of made me laugh was the fact that they actually showed that he had nothing beneath his torso. And yet clearly what was underneath him was enough space for legs, which must have been sort of a very painful irony for Davros to be sitting in a wheelchair the whole time, which has space for legs, but he has no legs to put in them.
Yeah. I want to know how he was actually sitting up in the chair without legs. Like, is there a socket that his spine is plugged into? I know he's got the shoulder braces, but, like, how's he actually sitting up in there? Not criticism, it's just a curiosity now. And
well, that's it. It's not a criticism. It is just talking about it. I mean, I don't...
Yeah.
It doesn't change the whole thing. I mean, the whole Doctor Who is ludicrous anyway. So you've got to let some stuff go. But it is a sort of fun thing to think about. It's like, I mean, does that mean that... Perhaps he has false legs in there that sort of work as legs, which could be pulled out and removed. Or maybe it's a stash of things that he can have in
there. He's got stash in there?
Well, that's it, exactly. What could he have stashed in there?
Cybermen.
Aero bars.
Aero bars?
He likes snacks. Have you seen his teeth? He probably eats those things like every meal. Jeez. You know, one thing I did actually enjoy, though, was that Moffat, through the Doctor, asked the question that we've all been asking ever since probably Journey's End. Which was, you can build yourself a cybernetic hand, but not cybernetic legs. You know, you call yourself a scientist. Thought that was pretty funny, because we've all been thinking that for quite a while now.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a funny little moment. I mean, there's it got me a little. I mean, part of me was thinking, yeah, this is a bit of a, you know, the tank moment again. You know, like in the previous episode, where you do something which is purely for show-off factor, isn't it? Because in the end, all he needed out of that chair... Well, I suppose perhaps he did need the chair because he didn't have time to see how the chair worked, but you'd presume all he would need was the mechanics. You wouldn't need to sit in the chair. It is a purely show-off moment. But it does sort of leave you with a couple of questions.
I think the difference is that maybe getting into Davros's chair is something that we've thought about as fans for like 40 years, whereas the Doctor playing the guitar on a tank is a great, massive kind of... It's you know, it's a narrative juxtaposition that just doesn't sit right within Doctor Who. It doesn't sit right as a visual because the character, that just isn't the character. And, you know, it's got all sorts of things wrong with it.
And the Doctor sitting in Davros's chair to me kind of seems like he's throwing things in the Daleks' faces. You know, like he's... look what I can do that you can't do kind of thing. I'm in your leader's chair, your creator's chair. Like, it's really just kind of like a slap in the face, whereas the tank thing was just, in my opinion, out of character. You know, I've thought about that a lot, too, and one of the things that I even realized was if they wanted to do a guitar in medieval England, all they had to do was have him create some kind of, like, battery-powered amp backpack and just have him at least walk in and do something. Like, that would have even made that moment slightly better for me. But the chair moment... I didn't mind. It was fun, especially when he suggested the bumper cars kind of aspect. I thought, you know, he's being really flippant. He's doing the thing the Doctor always does, which is misdirect with either his silliness or overconfidence by trying to not let them in on the secret that maybe he's not fully in control of things right now. I thought it was handled pretty well. It may have been a fan kind of idea or a fan kind of moment, but I felt this one worked here.
Yeah. I think that the other thing make it onto the compilation tape.
I mean, I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the moment with the chair. I thought it was nice. It was flippant. I mean, I suppose if you were looking at Devil's Advocate, there's always that worry about how much do you depower the Daleks in a story like that. And that's the danger when you put one character in a city full of impossible impossible foes, is that you've got to depower them to give him space. And suddenly, when you get the Doctor being very flippant like that, the risk is you're obviously making them seem less dangerous. And I suppose if there was one argument you might have against the episode, is that it did suffer a little bit, like the Cybermen in the finale, that they were pretty impotent all the way through. I mean, apart
until
from
the end, when they were suddenly Nightmare in Steel, weren't they?
Yeah.
When
but even
suddenly
then,
become superpowered Daleks.
But even then, the superpowered Daleks, as soon as it was all going wrong, not one of them fired a shot off. Or they didn't seem that worried about the Daleks firing a shot off. You know, the Dalek. I mean, it's like if you stick your hand in a hornet's nest with a load of poison, a few of the hornets will come and think to sting you because hornets are buggers like that, or you know, wasps are. And I just, there's always that risk that when there's bedlam, suddenly the enemy becomes neutered. And I think that's, again, that's a danger, I think, that shows you've always got to be careful of. This is that suddenly the moments when they're escaping and the Daleks are all confused, that the Daleks suddenly lose their power. And the Daleks didn't seem to have that much power in the episode. But then the story wasn't really about the Daleks. It was about Davros. So you can excuse it. So it's not a bad thing. As I say, it didn't bother me at all. But if you're doing these sort of 40, 50-minute talks on an episode, these are sort of things that come up.
Oh, yeah, sure. Now, listen, we've got 8 viewers at the moment, so hey, 8 viewers. I was talking to my wife last night, because we've been away, as my colleagues here know, we've been away for a night for the first time without our children, so we've had the chance to actually have a conversation for the first time in 4 years. And I've completely forgotten what the conversation was now, you see, because that's what children do to your brain. I'm just completely scrambled. But we've got 8 viewers, so that's it. The fact that we've got like 3,000 to 5,000 listeners and we can't quantify any more than that is quite a strange situation. So it's nice to have 8 people with us actually live. It'd be nice to have just one person with us live, although obviously we would then therefore know who our listener is. But then again, we know who our listener is. Hello, Stephen. I hope you're well today. And celebrating your 3.7 million viewers. So 8 viewers on the podcast here. We haven't got far to go, guys, to catch up. If you would like to comment to us, you can speak to us on Twitter or Facebook. Or there's this group chat thing over here, which there's a button up this side that you can press, and then you can talk to us over here. So by all means, do that. And I've got it open so I can listen to you. And you can also comment on the Hangouts feed itself, which I haven't checked just yet. I don't know if any of the other guys have checked. I'm going to check it in a moment. We've just lost 2 viewers, so I'm guessing that's by Stephen. There you go. It's got to run this one, I tell you. And everything we tell you is based in fact. Okay, so. Moron. And sewer are 2 excellent words. And both 5 letters long, and they both appeared in last night's episode of Doctor Who. Now, taking the thing about the Daleks going to the trouble of rebuilding Skarrow aside, because I'm not entirely sure why they would have bothered rebuilding it, if they've got time travel technology and they really wanted Skarrow back, and if we assume that the Skarrow that we were talking about was the one that was destroyed at the end of Remembrance of the Daleks, they could have just done a little bit like what the Doctor did, and just pinch Skarrow at the last minute with their own time travel technology, and then not have to go to the trouble of rebuilding it. Because, I say this, because if they went to the trouble of rebuilding it, would they really have had that many Dalek failures in the sewers? Or, you know, the immortal Daleks that won't die, that have been flushed away in their sewer under the Dalek city? That's the only problem I had with that particular aspect. It was a great thing.
We don't know how long the Time War was, and we don't know if Skarrow is connected to all of that, so I suppose there's potential for that. I did have a similar thought when they said that, too, that it did seem like it was so old. But then, you know, the other thing is, with the TV show about time travel, we also don't know where it is in its own particular timeline. Maybe they rebuilt it, but we're seeing it thousands of years after they had done that. I suppose there's ways out for all of that sort of stuff, but there's also detractors if they misstep with a line somewhere down the line to say that maybe it was like 2 days old. You know, why would you go ahead and recreate your sewers as well with that many dead? I did appreciate that they had given some kind of response for how it could be there, though, or how it was back. And obviously it was a reactionary thing when you think about it, of course, going back to the 11th Doctor's era where Scarrow was there and we were all asking that question, but it's not like that's anything new to Doctor Who. Russell T. Davis used to do the same thing when fans would have particular issues. He would address it in a future episode.
Yeah. Brian, can I just ask, just freeze?
Yes.
Okay. And then if you just move your head just a little bit to your left.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and now just a bit to the right, just slightly to the right. Stop right there. Right, speak. Okay.
Speaking.
Okay, can you see? Everyone, right, Brian, do not move. At the moment, Brian looks exactly the same as his chest of drawers behind him. He's got two eyes, then frames around the outline of the drawers, and then he's got another drawer handle in the same position as his microphone. Brian, speak.
Speaking. Wow, whoops. That's me.
You see? Yeah. Yeah. Isn't it amazing when podcasters look like their own chest of drawers?
Yeah, it's great, man.
Yeah. Sorry, do carry on. I'm sorry.
No, quite all right. Yeah, I was done.
Okay. Hey, another thing. Should we get that sort of explanation? It's just like a single line or just a few words that just quickly explain something. What we didn't get is how Davros survived the Stolen Earth and how Missy survived... the Doctor Who Series 8 finale, Dark Water, Death in Heaven. Did we?
Yeah, she explained that she did the whole Vortex Manipulator power thing. Oh, just that's like, right. Yeah, so the way that they survived the Series 9 opener was the same thing. Yeah.
Yeah, we still don't know how she escaped the other thing, though, which was being a man.
Yeah, and being dragged back into the Time War at the end of Time.
Yeah, which is quite a big story, one would have thought.
Yeah.
Who are we to beg Stephen? Could you maybe tell us that sometime? We know you're listening. And hi, Stephen Moffat. Hello, and any other blogger who may be watching. Okay, has anyone got any of their own observations about the Witch's Familiar?
Wow, I'm sure.
Well,
I
how did you watch it?
How did I watch it? I used my eyes, much like Davros. I turned the center one off. Wanted to see it with my own eyes. It was good that way. It was very good. I had to watch. I was out all day long, so I had to watch it on my computer.
Okay, that's interesting.
Self-admittedly, I wasn't. I just wasn't home, so I wasn't able to watch it.
Okay. And Andy McLean, how did you watch it?
Watched it when it was on.
Okay, good man. He's one of the 3.7 million. Which is down on 4.6 million from last week. I watched it on my phone at about... I watched it after Casualty, because I was in a hotel and they didn't have iPlayer. But they did have really good Wi-Fi. I was surprised how good their Wi-Fi was, actually. I don't think I've ever been in a hotel with such good Wi-Fi. It downloaded the 276 megabytes for the small, you know, that size screen. So a perfect resolution for that size screen. 276 megabytes, it downloaded in about 10 or 15 minutes. So for a hotel, that's really good going. And then Kerry and I watched it on our phone. Kerry was feeling a bit unwell, actually, so we went out for a meal. And then we had to come, we basically came straight back home because she's caught a cold off somebody, probably my son. So, but yeah, watched it on the phone, and that was good. We did plenty throughout the day. You know, it wasn't a disaster. Don't get me wrong. It's not a sob story about like a night's way that just went terribly wrong. It was absolutely fine. It was a nice bar there. Oh, I didn't tell you where I was though, did I? Which is of particular interest to Doctor Who fans, particularly fans of Gareth Roberts' Series 4 story, The Unicorn and the Wasp, because we were at the Old Swan Hotel, which is where the Doctor dropped Agatha Christie. It's the real-life hotel where she vanished to in 1926, when she discovered her husband's infidelity. In real life, she didn't probably have an adventure with a Time Lord and a giant wasp, but she did end up in Harrogate. And that's where Mrs. Castorbis and myself spent the night. So nice hotel, nice Wi-Fi as well.
So back to the show, what did you... Because one thing that I've heard a couple of people bring up and it seemed to confuse people was the explanations of how Daleks work, which some people came back saying that they presume that Daleks inside weren't actually particularly hateful. It was just the machine that makes them hateful. Which I didn't get the impression was quite what was trying to be suggested, but was something that people were taking away from it.
I got the impression that the machine aspect of it was quite limited, and maybe there was some kind of margin of error, so that if a Dalek started to go rogue, then what it expressed wasn't what it really wanted to express, so it was kind of then continue to be trapped inside that tank to continue to go a bit mad. But I never got that sort of impression, no.
What about you, Brian? How did you interpret it?
Well, my initial reaction was just I thought the idea was really kind of lame that emotions fired their guns or loaded their guns and made them say certain things, like when Clara was trying to speak, because in the past we had Ian in a Dalek saying very Ian-like things, but then the more I realized what was going on, Ian was never plugged into the unit. He was essentially driving it by like hand controls, if you will, and being able to just speak, I guess, through the microphone. So as far as new information goes, I couldn't really find much that could contradict what we were being told. I don't quite like the concept that Daleks might be in their cases being okay people who are, essentially being made to be Daleks just because their tank, their body, interprets whatever they're saying as hostile. I would still prefer to think that the Daleks themselves are hostile. Although there is a certain kind of, I don't want to say poetic element to it, but I guess there's something to it that maybe a Dalek, the frustration that they have, this frustration that they build up is from when they're born, they get shoved in this case, they're trying to tell people their maybe innermost secrets, but it just keeps coming out as hostility, and then that hostility just builds into proper hostility because they can't say what they want to say. They're stymied, essentially, by their creator. So I don't know. It's a very odd thing to look at. I'm not sure I'm full processing how I properly feel about it, because there are certain aspects I think are interesting about it and certain aspects that I kind of wish weren't there. I think sometimes some things that we have in the show that we hold on to that we know what they are essentially through and through, I feel a lot of times they don't need that extra bit of explanation. They are what they are, and that's perfect as it is. I don't think this explanation really ruined things, but I don't necessarily think it was needed either. But it's interesting to think about the philosophical.
It's sort of malleable. I mean, in the end, you could always just say, well, this is a specific type of Dalek from a specific era, which she'd be able to recognize. And it may be an era, as you say, which either utilized the approach to Daleks in a different way. I mean, yeah, she did sort of say that's why they always say exterminate, exterminate. But you kind of sort of make that sense, because you always assume that they were driven through rather sort of mental abilities rather than sort of gear shifts. So how they were feeling would possibly be linked to their actions. So I didn't mind it too much. I think I can understand why people were confused by it, but I just got the impression it was sort of saying that the machine sort of worked on negative emotions, essentially. That was what focused it, that's what it generated, that's what it worked around, rather than it was, and if you weren't particularly negative emotions, it would still be working through those things. I don't know, it was a bit of a weird moment. It was kind of interesting, and I did like the fact that she was in there, because it was an incredibly claustrophobic approach, because she was trapped, not just physically, but verbally. And I thought that was a very neat way to give her a bit of claustrophobia and actually give some malevolence to the Daleks, which wasn't done in the usual way of them killing everyone.
Yeah, no, so, I'd agree with that. I think it's one of the strongest parts of the episode, actually.
It is curious to think how she may have overcome that way back when with Asylum of the Daleks, not that Clara, but whatever version of Clara was in there, ridden that kind of speech pattern, because she was able to speak with the Doctor normally. Well,
that was another thing that interests me, was the one bit that I really hated in The Big Bang is when the Dalek says to River Song, "Mercy."
Yeah.
Which I always felt was a terrible thing, because it gave River Song an unrequited power that she didn't deserve. As I think we said at the time, the Doctor deserves this power, because as a viewer, we see it. We see the evidence of how many times he's defeated them. So he's allowed to have that. But if you don't have that, you shouldn't be able to get a Dalek to say mercy just because the audience is meant to assume that imbues that person with such power. It's, to me, that was wrong. But it is kind of interesting if you look at it retrospectively. I mean, I don't doubt for a second that he's aware of that. And
well, he listens to the podcast, so he probably is.
Do you think you might? It might be worth just explaining a little about this without giving names, because this is.
We'll talk about it a little bit later, maybe.
Well, you know, because it. I'm just worried that people are going to sort of.
Okay. All right then. Yeah. All right then. So. Okay. I'm going to very, very briefly, and then we're not going to talk about it again. But I'm going to refer to it consistently, continuously for the rest of time. Basically, we have been given information by a extremely impeccable source, the type of source that gives us information that we can't talk about, you know, between seasons and during the seasons and things like that. And the gist of it is that at least one party, probably two parties, are compiling dossiers about Castorbras and other Doctor Who websites and passing these on to the production team at BBC Wales in terms of what's the general attitude is towards a series, what general attitude is towards a producer or writer, mainly producer. I think you know who I'm talking about. So from that, we've learned that clips of the podcast have been played. So this may or may not have a bearing on why we're able to, or why we're unable, I should say, to get previews of Doctor Who Series 9. Whatever. If you're going to... the BBC are very happy to send us press releases for merchandise. They seem less keen to enable us to review an episode before it airs. But then again, if you're not going to even promote your episodes properly before they air, if you're not going to tell people that there's Daleks and Davros in your episodes before they air, then perhaps that's why you're having to... make a Sunday afternoon omnibus repeat.
But the bottom line is that to be very blunt about it is that for you as someone who runs a website, I don't know if hurt is the wrong way, but it sort of is very disillusioning if you can hear this sort of alleged stuff going on.
Yeah.
That this stuff might be going on and everything becomes very territorial. And it feels like it doesn't do anyone any service. You know, if stuff's people are hearing stuff out of context, that doesn't help them.
No.
It doesn't help the work that people put into these sort of things, these productions. And, you know, these are just opinions. You take or leave them. No one is saying it's fact. And if you disagree, that's wonderful. And as I always say in these comments, you know, if I say I don't like something and you did, well, you won and I didn't. I'm here having to explain why I didn't like it. You can sit there content liking it.
Yeah.
So no one's winning in it.
No, I think the main thing about it is that it's just very, 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 very incredibly very silly, in my opinion.
Yes.
We're talking so Monty Python, Graham Chapman dressed as Colonel walking on. Stop this! This is silly, sort of level of silliness now.
This sort of stuff happens everywhere, but when it happens in work, you know, money's involved, you think, well, you know, I'm being paid for a job. If there's silly stuff going out there, that's part of the business. When you're doing something because you enjoy it and you're not making any money out of it and you're spending time to sort of do something that all the community can interact with and enjoy, it becomes disheartening because it is silly and you just think, what's the point if things are become so complex.
Yeah. Yeah.
My point being is that you know, I want people who are listening to this, if they're suddenly thinking, why does Christian sound sort of verging on angry? I think it is a disheartening, silly stuff which
I wasn't aware I was verging on angry, actually.
You sound
like a nice cup of ginger tea here to keep me calm.
To keep you calm? Inferring that you would be angry if you didn't have any ginger tea. Ginger tea actually make you more angry? Isn't the gingeriness of it? And I don't mean that. I don't even talk about ginger hair.
I think the thing for me is that you take any quote from any actor from Doctor Who over the years, or any article that was out there, or any of those clickbait articles that you see where You know, they say something that's so outrageous that you just have to click that title to see, oh my God, what are they doing to my show right now? And then you click in there and you find out that it's nonsense. They took something out of context completely, and that article had a completely different meaning if all you did was read the title. And half the people would read the title, get pissed off at the title alone, not read the article, and walk away thinking whoever said what they said were complete assholes. For me, if you're going to go ahead and take snippets of the things that we say completely out of context and ignore the other things that we do say that we do appreciate and not present the full picture, it's just petty. And it seems like you're out for your own needs, your own gains, rather than actually trying to benefit the show or the people who run the show or anybody connected to the show in any way. You're not doing anybody any favors. It's never fun to be misrepresented. And I know for a fact, you know, Stephen Moffat doesn't like that himself. The man left Twitter for being hacked for being misrepresented and so on. And it's just, it's not right, no matter how you cut it. It's petty, it's ridiculous, it's silly, it's childish. And I just think, you know, if people want to get the full picture, hey, take the time, listen in, you'll see where we're at. Especially, you take a look at what happened. The first episode, we were not very complimentary about, but the ratings were high. They were pretty good. Well, what did that first episode do that made people come to this episode? You know, like Christian said, there was a sporting event on, maybe that had something to do with it, but we've seen this before in the past. Part one of a story, not so hot, people walk away from it. Part two of a story is really good, but people didn't watch it because they walked away because that first part just wasn't up to par. You know, but here we are, we're actually praising the thing legitimately, you know, because it was a good episode. But who's going to know that? You know, we appreciate the listeners that we have. We appreciate everybody that's out there. But these are just our thoughts and opinions. Everybody's thoughts and opinions are different. I don't see why a website or a podcast should sit there and only say that something was great if that's not how you really feel. That's just not fair.
I think the other problem is that as much as, you know, people think it's cool that, you know, some person important might listen to it, these podcasts aren't made for them. No. These podcasts are made for... Right. Audiences. We're not here to talk to anyone on the production team. If people on the production or the BBC listen to this, that's their choice. You know, we can't stop that. That's their call. But it's not aimed at them. This is not to get any message to them. It's just us talking to people who watch the show. So it sort of makes it a little harder if, and I don't know, I don't know who the contact is. I don't know what's going on here. I only know what Christian has said to me. If there is any alleged stuff like this going on, it is frustrating. Because it hampers a little on how we say things, because I don't want to offend anyone. I don't care. I stand by any of my opinions, but I, you know, I don't particularly want someone who has spent, you know, God knows how many days, months working on a show, hearing me criticizing it particularly.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it just feels like, you know, that would be hurtful. So I'd rather they weren't listening to it. I'd rather they'd be working on the shows, you know, what they should be doing. So it's frustrating to know if stuff's taken out of context and given to people who wouldn't otherwise listen to it. You're hurting their feelings, their egos. It's just frustrating, and it means that when you have a good episode like this, you start feeling like, oh, now if I'm actually nice about it, people are going to think it's because of that or because someone might be listening, and that's frustrating because it's not at all. So yeah, anyway, I just thought it might as well early on.
Yeah, all right. No, fair enough. And, you know, I just want to just make a couple of things clear about this, is that first, I mean, as far as I'm concerned, we made the podcast for the three of us. You know, we just have a weekly conversation with each other. If you enjoy it, then that's brilliant for us. As I say, we don't know beyond, we only know how many people listen on Casterbus. We only know how many people listen through Audio Boom. We're now available on player.fm. We're available on stitch.com, but I don't believe either of those have any sort of analytics or any method of counting. So, you know, we've got between 3,000 and 5,000 listeners week to week changes. So, you know, if you're one of those guys, you presumably are because you're listening now, then, you know, if you enjoy it, then that's great for us. I should also say as well, this isn't about Casterbus. We are not the only site or the only podcast that has been targeted in this way, okay? So if you're a .2 website or podcast and you've not been treated in the way that you had been previously, then this is just, you know, bear this in mind. There's a very strong chance that you're also someone who's being treated in the same way as us, and maybe you need to look around for some answers. They will be extremely obvious to you once you think about them. So, we've been rambling on for 40, 50 minutes. Now, we've got some comments on Twitter, actually, I wanted to mention. Gareth Lloyd says, surely we can expect a Doctor in Davros chair figure soon, as well as Sonic Sonic sunglasses. I think a Doctor in Davros chair would be brilliant. You know, they're bringing out this new Missy figure. I think they've missed a trick there. Character Options are doing a 5.5-inch Missy. I think they should have been doing a Doctor in Davros chair first. What'd you say? Am I allowing in this?
It's making me wonder, is it going to be one of those things where he's just permanently stuck in the chair himself, or are you going to have a chair that you can put anybody in Davros's chair?
Yeah. No, I like that. That's good as well, yeah. Do the 5.5-inch figures, Brian? I know you may know the answer to this. Do they have knee joints, knee bends?
They do, yeah. Wow. I mean, I don't recall any that don't, but yeah, you know, they most of them do, for sure.
Yeah, so, yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. Oh, come on, yeah. Character Options, do it!
Exactly.
Arnold Schwarzenegger to say, do it! What did you
think of Missy this time? Because again, reading people on Facebook and the like, this she seems a little like River Song, that people either really like her or really find her hot.
I have this difficulty with her personally, and I don't think my opinion on the matter has really changed, is that Michelle Gomez is absolutely fantastic as Missy. I just don't buy Missy as being the master. I would happily watch her in every episode, to be honest with you. I just do not buy her as being the master.
No, that's okay. I was going to say, here's something I was actually thinking about when I watched it. You know, she was very quick to, I mean, which I guess is true because of reform, but she was very quick to correct the Dalek that she's a Time Lady, not a Time Lord. She considers it an upgrade, and she calls herself Missy. But do you think that was actually Moffat realizing that some people wouldn't accept her as the master, and so therefore essentially made her be both the master and her own character by giving her this Missy name so that it would be easier to accept for some people?
Well, I'm still not... I was watching, I was thinking maybe there is a chance that this actually isn't the master. That, you know, we are taking a lot on face value on what's said. You know, maybe there will be a twist in the end which will thrill 50% of people who believe it shouldn't be the master. That it's not, and it is their own character, because there could be, as he's writing it, it might start to feel more and more like Missy is her own character and doesn't need or works better without, or even better, you could have the master and Missy in an episode and split the two up, and maybe there's no need to. I mean, I don't mind. My only issue with Missy is the same issue I have with River Song, is, and I was talking to someone else about this, and it was them who actually brought this up and made me think about it. Is that there is a certain factor of feeling that she is utterly unstoppable. While if you sort of look at Delgado, Delgado's master would be very often having to rethink and change and strategically move his plans into different directions. And while Missy was doing that a bit in this episode, you almost feel like she knows the outcome. She's that godly that, in a sense, maybe she needs to be pulled back a little. And at the same time, I think she just, the way she's written and the way she's played out is brilliant. I find her really enjoyable to watch. But there is that factor that she does sometimes feel like she's a little too impossible.
You know, there's something I said last podcast where I was saying that I think Moffat needs to let go of his comedic past and kind of just let the comedic moments work themselves out a little bit better. And I have to say, like, I agree with what you're saying, and I definitely see what you're saying there, but a lot of the things that worked for me with Missy were a lot of the comedic undertones with her. I mean, you know, something as simple and silly as constantly fooling Clara, you know, look down this pit, look into this device, you know, and Clara's doing it. And those things were just so simple, but they were funny, and they worked. And I don't know, perhaps it's a major credit to Michelle Gomez that she can make them work and not overplay them while at the same time essentially kind of overplaying them, because that's what the character is, you know? But yeah, I don't know. It's a lot of that stuff that she does, a lot of the things she does, a lot of the way she is written works for me in a way that's very different from River Song, whereas I felt River Song was arrogant and cocky, and I usually don't like that in characters. It's very off-putting for me, and I've always said this, unless they are a villain. which is probably why it works well for Missy, because you do know that they're not going to win at the end. They are going to get their comeuppance in some way. And with Missy, the main thing that she's got going for her is she survives. You know, she doesn't seem like she wins or gets the goal that she wants, or maybe she's getting, like, you know, bits and pieces of that goal for the grander scheme probably at the end of the season. But in some ways, maybe, I just feel it works better for her than Riversong.
Well, maybe the reason it works for Missy to a degree where it doesn't for River as much, in my opinion anyway, is maybe because she is connected to the Master. So you feel her ability to sort of almost walk over the episode with just humour without any particular worry is justified, while River isn't, because we've had, like I said earlier with the Doctor, we've seen the Master for so long that we can accept that that's the sort of power we'd accept the Master to have, but not many other characters. So she has earned her right to be that sort of omni-god that other characters wouldn't be quite as allowed to have. And I suppose what I did also quite like is the way that she had with Clara, a little reminiscent of Joe Grant and Delgado. And there was a sort of half friendship there that was sort of born often out of pressures rather than alignment. You can't have that with the Master. That was fun. I did like that.
Yeah, I mean, it was a bit jarring. We talked about last time that, you know, here's Missy going around killing people and the Doctor and Clara are just kind of like pally-pally with her and so on. But, you know, it is kind of a necessity kind of thing. You know, we have to remember that Clara was kind of stuck with the Master on an alien complex home world. You know, what are you really going to do except for maybe stick around with the one person who might possibly be able to save your life? So it does make sense. And it did seem like, you know, the characters... The one thing I can say about Clara is she's certainly got, you know, a bold personality. And when you put her with somebody like the Master, the two of them certainly will play off each other very well, as they did. Which I was glad to see, because a lot of times I don't really like Clara's interactions with people anymore, because she just seems like that, I don't know, bossy, stereotypical type character that Moff tends to write. But she seemed to work well in this story. Hopefully she'll work well for the rest of Season 9. I would like to see her go out well, rather than happy to see the back end of her kind of thing.
What's about the regeneration, the use of regeneration? This is something which has been bugging. Well, I only started bugging me when I was watching yesterday. It was the only part of the show which I felt I didn't quite as enjoy as much. Was I tend to feel in regeneration it's something which should be ignored or left alone. Mm. Sort of a bit like the TARDIS to a degree, that if you over-focus on it, it can start to dominate the episode, or the show can start turning in on itself too much. That it's something that's good to create transitions for new character, for new doctors. But beyond that, I kind of like it being forgotten. Otherwise, it becomes too much of a plot device. And today, I wasn't quite sure how it was really working, or whether it jarred a little with the more subtleties of the Dr. Davros thing, or whether it's... I don't know. I didn't dislike it. I still thought it worked all right. But I... Just another topic.
I totally appreciate what you're saying there, and I can go along with it to a certain extent. I think it was. I don't want to say. If I'm going to say that, I was going to get into a sort of a negative thing, and I don't want to be negative about this episode. So we're faced with a situation where the Doctor's talking to old, let's call him Pub Davros. Okay, he's gone. His wife's died, and he's basically drinking himself to death. So he's going down the pub every day, having a bit of a talk with people, same old people there all the time, and he talks about his regrets, and, you know, he's gone there to drink himself to death and die. And, you know, this happens. I've come across this over the years in different scenarios. People do sort of, like, give up, and they just find something to do to, like, pass the time away. So, you know, Davros, we'll call him Pub Davros, and Capaldi's maybe, yeah, he's the landlord of, you know, the TARDIS Tavern, and old Pub Davros isn't really dying, because he's got a plan, and then, you know, we think that he's reeled the Doctor in. Obviously he hasn't reeled the Doctor in, and the Doctor maybe is in the situation where this is the only way he's going to get out of it, by doing the old, I mean, it's essentially a colony SARF facilitated version of reversing the polarity of the neutron flow. He's overloaded Davros's plan, hasn't he, essentially? And Davros hasn't thought the plan through properly. The Doctor's overloaded it. And if you think about it that way, then I can go along with it. But I am totally on board with what you said about the use of regeneration, and it should be just, you know, at the beginning and end of eras, and really shouldn't impede on other things. You get into an Arc of Infinity sort of situation, don't you? Or a Margin Undead, even, I should say, sort of situation.
But it starts to become more of a weapon rather than a biology. Time of the Doctor.
Or a possession that people can target.
Like I have antibodies that stop me from getting a cold. Someone can come and take them and stop them from having a cold. I don't know. I suppose it could be a good story, but it just feels like it becomes something more than it should be. At the same time, and again, yeah, this is exactly what I meant earlier about the end. You end up starting to sound like you're overly trying to be nice about something, and I'm not. It didn't take the pleasure out of watching it. I kind of liked seeing Davros as they were playing him. I found that really interesting. And I was very interested in the sunrise as well. And then when he turned around and it was all a bit of a plan, I was a bit disappointed, yet at the same time part of me was saying, well, come on, it's Davros. You can't really expect him to have not do this. This is just really what he does, isn't it?
Yeah. I think when they got it as well, when they turned it around, I think it was just gone past that point of thinking, blimey, he really has changed.
Yeah, it was good timing.
Yeah, excellent timing on that. Just jumping onto Twitter, Robin Cook, not the former Foreign Secretary, obviously, says, loving the podcast, guys. Great to see nearly all of you. Thanks, Robin. Nice to hear from you there. And on the Hangout page, we also have Colin Grigson, who has a few things to say. After the Doctor borrowed Davros's Dalek-esque chair, I was hoping we'd see Davros get about in some robot legs. He also says, does the influence of the Doctor in Davros's childhood do harm to the formation of the despotic Davros that we've come to know? As the Doctor helped Davros in that life or death situation, surely Davros would have learned the value of compassion. And he also says, do you think we've got any hints so far for what the series arc might be, if they have one? I thought Mrs. Lyne about her daughter might have been one. I haven't got any idea about the season arc, to be honest. I've got a vague idea, which might be something to do with regeneration, but other than that, I don't know.
I'm hoping they're straying away from regeneration stuff, to be honest.
Yeah, I just have a feeling after we've seen that and something else that I've heard that maybe it is regeneration. Just on the second point, though, because we did talk about fingerprints last week, and the Doctor's fingerprint all over the universe, and in particular in Dalek history, and now into Davros history. And this has kind of been considerably mitigated now, because it's spun around, isn't it? Like, what we were concerned about last week hasn't come to pass in the way that we were concerned about it.
Well, it has to a degree.
Yeah, well, that's what I say, not in the way that we were concerned about it. It's come to pass in a different way.
Well, not really. His fingerprint is still there, because if not, in fact, it has come in the way that is, again, not wanting to be too negative, but it has come out in the bad way, because it now means that the only reason that Davros exists is because the Doctor helped him, which means you can put the Doctor as being the catalyst for the Daleks. If he hadn't been there, Davros would be dead, and there would be no Dalek. So,
would Davros be dead?
Well, I mean, someone else could have saved him, or he could have found his own ingenious way out. Yes, there's, you know, it's fiction. There's no way to say anything for sure. But the inference is that the Doctor saved Davros from dying when he was a child, which answers the question posed by the first episode, which is fine, that's absolutely fair. But it does mean that fingerprint of the Doctor, which is something I'm just finished an article on, actually, which is finished yesterday, and so it talks a bit about this, is very much part of the Dalek history, which is a very big fingerprint now. Mm.
You know, ordinarily I'm with you on that sort of thing. I generally, you know, when Clara went through and saved every one of the Doctor's lives by jumping into his time stream, and she was basically responsible for everything, even the Doctor grabbing the particular TARDIS that he did, I really disliked that, because it really made it seem like there was just nothing that the Doctor actually did on his own. But here, it was reminiscent to me of the actual Doctor Who universe from the very second story. You know, the Doctor has no idea who the Daleks are when he first meets them in that story, the Daleks. You know, and he's got no idea, but yet, soon enough, they become the mortal enemy of the Time Lords. And you have to wonder, would they have left Skaro and started to become the scourge of the galaxy had the Doctor not come there and shown them that, you know, they could leave it too and that there was more out there in the universe? You know, like, so in a sense, it's like the Doctor was responsible for the Daleks becoming what they were, not necessarily being born. So here, kind of having that almost repeated again with Davros, but in a more kind of direct way, I didn't mind so much. I agree with you, James. It's definitely a heavy fingerprint for him there, and in many respects, I would prefer that it wasn't the case. But at the same time, I kind of like that the Doctor kind of has this relationship with the Daleks, that if he wasn't out in the universe doing what he's doing, maybe the Daleks wouldn't be either. And I, for this instance, I was kind of okay with it. Other ones in the past, when too many things tried to get explained, even going back as far as the sound the TARDIS makes when it lands, being the brakes being left on, things like that really bugged the hell out of me. But this one, for some reason, I felt it kind of harkened back to that moment, and they have this dance they're destined to do with each other, that one kind of almost can't exist without the other in a way.
Okay.
Just create a very dark question to the Doctor Who universe, though, doesn't it? There's so much. I mean, if you consider, in fact, you could argue it embellishes it in a different way, and I should write another article on this, really, rather than say now. But you've got the issue that, you know, if you sort of say that Genesis of the Daleks, you have this comment from a Time Lord that says the Daleks eventually dominate everything, and you think, well, now, you know, the Daleks were catalyzed by the interference of a Time Lord. So in a sense, the Daleks become a plague or a virus almost created by people from outside the timelines. And it all becomes a very topsy-turvy world. But, yeah.
Just jumping back into the Hangouts, Colin just asked, the Doctor didn't regenerate, did he? I just thought Davros used some of the Doctor's regeneration energy. And yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about. Just not the fact that he regenerated or an actual regeneration, but just the use of the whole regeneration sort of sub-mythos.
What Song was able to do was just to sort of call up the energy when she wanted, and that seemed to sort of start going down this role that it's almost like Spider-Man's web spinners now, that you can just fire them out when you like, rather than, you know, I can't get my antibodies to kick in when I want them to. They only kick in when they need to. And I think that's where it possibly needs to be reined back a bit. Otherwise, it starts to become a superpower. And that's not really what I think it works best as. I think also the danger when it becomes a superpower, it makes the person more super. Because you start thinking, well, why can't he use his Time Lord energy? I know he's only got a certain amount of it, but, you know, who cares? You know, the whole point of the Doctor is you've got to try and make him vulnerable. And I suppose it's a battle for every producer and every writer, that balance between trying to make it feel like this Doctor could die, and yet at the same time this Doctor can equally regenerate whenever there's a problem. So, you know, where's the dividing line?
Yeah, okay.
Just taking on a wasp at the same time. Anyway, carry on.
No, you're taking on a wasp? We're back to Agatha Christie.
It was a very dopey, very small one, and
I hope you won.
Well, I was kind of pleased I did, given the sheer scales and the fact that it was dying and I wasn't.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, well, we're all dying in the end, aren't we?
Well, yeah, you could be. Hey, listen, now, I was thinking, you know, we do recommendations every week, and I was thinking maybe we could do a different section, which is things that we saw which we wish we hadn't seen.
Not at all, more complicated.
The thing is, and you know, if there's any children listening, switch off now. I was watching TV last night in the hotel room, and you know, it wasn't, you know, I just want to just draw a line there. I'm not talking blue here. I'm sorry, it's one of those strange sort of bizarre bodies, you know. Was that show they have on Channel 5 where people show off their bizarre physical deformities or whatever.
Right.
It was along that sort of lines. And it was basically about the length of a gentleman's genitalia. And, yeah, I stumbled across this program not knowing what it was. I was just flicking through plus, and I see a procedure taking place in some sort of theatre. And then it carries on with a guy being interviewed with an actor's voice, I should add, an actor who was doing his stupidest, most stupid, dumb, ingrate sort of voice, explaining on behalf of the guy being interviewed that the procedure was conducted by... And just a quick recap, we're talking about a procedure on a gentleman's genitalia. The procedure was conducted by a neurosurgeon. Yeah.
Okay.
So that was my thing that I saw, which I wish I hadn't seen for this week. Maybe we'll do that again sometime, I don't know. Who knows? So we'll skip the recommendations. We suggest that if you're not... Well, it's too late to watch that now, I think. If you haven't already watched The Witch's Familiar and its first part, The Magician's Apprentice, that you do so and watch them to get as close together as you can. Because we are sure that you will find that in the time on the tradition of James McLean's famous theory that you can have a bad beginning and a bad middle, but you can't have a bad end. It has a great end, and it lifts the story. And it maybe doesn't entirely forgive the nonsense in Essex with the guitar and the tank, but it does, by the time you've got to the end of the episode, you've forgotten that stuff, and you've got some really great 50 minutes of Doctor Who. So that's it for this week's podcast with a K. As I say, we'll have something slightly different next week, a discussion of the episode and hopefully a report or something from the Hinchcliffe event at the Fab Cafe in Manchester. Until next time, dear casterwrights and bloggers who like Doctor Who and anyone Scottish with wiry microphone-style hair. We wish you goodbye until next time. And we know you'll be back. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Cerberus Podcast. Christian Holly, James McLean, and Brian Terranova.